Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to the Runner's World podcast with me, Rick Pearson.
And me, Ben Hobson.
Today, we're speaking with fellow podcasters Adam, Laura and Ned, who have recently launched Streets Ahead. And I caught up with elite marathoner and COVID-19 doctor, Eleanor Davis. How you doing, Ben? You all right?
Yeah, I'm all right, thanks, mate. Very well. How's your lockdown three quarters of the Women's World Record challenges going?
Very good, thank you. I had to go at the mile world record. So that for me, three quarters of the distance was 1,207 metres. And time to beat, 4:12. And I actually ran pretty much four on the dot. So did it fairly easily this time, which was a surprise, I'll be honest.
So what's next?
Yeah, 3,000 metres next for me.
Right.
So this is another long-standing one. 8:06.11 set by China's Wang Jingjia in 1993. There's always alarm bells there when something's been standing that long. But, you know, I won't be cynical. That's the time to beat. So 2,250 metres for me in 8:06. So let's see how it
punchy.
Goes.
Punchy.
Well, I'll tell you what, Ben, should we welcome our guest of the week then?
Yeah, sure, let's do that thing.
Guest of the week, here in the studio. Guest of the week, sometimes on the phone. Could be an athlete, could be a physio, or a complete unknown.
Aside from their many other talents, Adam Tranter, Laura Laker and Ned Bolting have a new podcast called Streets Ahead. And it discusses infrastructure, transport, cycling, walking, and how the outlook and attitude on how we get about needs to change. Welcome to the Runner's World podcast.
Hi.
Thank you very much.
Hi, thank you.
You guys and your podcast is kind of focused on the future thinking of how we get about. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I think none of us thought that we'd be setting up a podcast, I think. COVID-19 has kind of left us in a position where we're sort of thinking, how can we make a difference? What can we talk about? And it's been something that's been on my mind for a while. And I've talked to Ned about it. Not a lot of people, you know, maybe having heard Ned on the telly talking about cycling from a sporting point of view, may not realize that how passionate he is about getting more people sort of cycling and walking in all forms. And Laura knows everything about this. Laura is the fountain of all knowledge, and is writing regularly on this topic in cycling and walking. So we've all kind of come together really, and ended up talking about what seems like a niche topic, but I think as you're discovering, Ben, the kind of topic of street design affects just about everybody without them realizing, and I think people are realizing it more than ever.
Well, yeah, I wanted to kind of fill in the gap, really, because you guys are cycling and walking in a sort of approach, and we obviously quite enjoy a bit of running, and we have an interest altogether that our pursuits are active ones. So I thought it was quite a nice way to sort of use your guys' knowledge and expertise and sort of talk about how all the worlds collide and all these different infrastructure changes and how that have happened and are happening during COVID-19 and how they might sort of impact on future things. But before we get into any of that, what's your, let's have a rundown of how everyone's relationship with running is right now.
Ah, well, can I kick off? It's Ned here. I wouldn't mind just chipping in on that, because running has been part of my life for about 15 years, and I feel very attached to running, probably actually more attached to running than I do cycling in terms of a kind of a sporting activity. Almost all my cycling now is pootling around to the shops and back. So it's very, it's excellent and it's the way forward, but it is kind of utilitarian, you know. Whereas running is what I do for exercise. I don't exercise on my bike. I run to exercise. I love it. I've been kind of quite compulsive about it for a number of years. And what I've found, I live in London, what I've found over the last two or three of these terrible weeks that we're all enduring is that I have started routinely running down the middle of the road. because that's the thing to do. And what I've noticed is, because, I mean, you stay away from people on the pavements. And what I've really noticed, been really interesting over the last few days, is that cars, what cars there are pootling up and down our streets at the moment, have started to understand why you might do that. Cars haven't understood anything, I should say, car drivers. They've started to understand why you might be actually in the middle of the road. And in most occasions, they've started to kind of defer to your right to be there, which is, you think that 4 or 5 weeks, unimaginable behavioural change.
Yeah, it's, and the sort of the bleeding off the pavement from, I mean, and guilty of it and have witnessed it many times, but the bleed from pavement to road as a runner when it was busy and when people were out doing stuff was quite commonplace, because you felt you needed to move out of the way of people and to be sort of conscientious of your space and moving faster and those sorts of things. But yeah, you know, you dabbled with death if you sort of went into the road too much, whereas now it feels like the best place to be.
Yeah, I mean, with my other hat on, the only time I've ended up in hospital after a bike accident was because of a pedestrian and not a car. Not a runner, as it happens. But there is that kind of, like, in normal times, sort of pre-COVID times, there is that, in terms of the built environment, that very, very dodgy grey area just on the road, just off the curb, where pedestrians quite often, and that's the bit you're talking about, isn't it? That in normal times, occasionally as a runner, you just, I'll just do this little bit on the road. And that is quite hazardous for cyclists, actually, because quite often pedestrians, they're kind of looking for cars and listening for cars, but they won't see a bike. And it's that first step into the road that often unseats a cyclist, and that creates a bit of collision. But anyway, that's just my take on those two experiences.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I guess we see the road space as a car space, but maybe the situation that we're seeing at the moment is giving us a bit of a different sense about, hang on, this is a street that is essentially a public space and is now an essential outlet for many of us who are walking or cycling or running. And maybe we're starting to see it differently, you know. I was standing in the road over the weekend taking a photo of something. It was just in the entrance of a cul-de-sac, and I had an Uber driver drive up to me. He was basically on the wrong side of the road, but I think he wanted to prove a point, and I was so outraged. But he was like, get out of the way, what are you doing in the road? And we had a bit of an argument. It wasn't very good. But I think maybe in my mind I was sort of reclaiming that space, because there are so few cars. In terms of my running, I only took up running, I think it was in 2017, I decided to do couch to 5K, and I got to 5K, and then I was like, oh, where next? I'm not really sure. And I kind of stopped, and it's something I revisit at Christmas when I go back to my family in Somerset, or it's something I picked up at the beginning of lockdown. But years ago I picked up what's usually a running injury, and I'd never run before in my life. I was having a massage before Ride London, which is a 100-mile bike ride from London back to London via Surrey. And the guy who's massaging me was saying, oh, do you run a lot? And I said, no. And then I thought, oh, swing dancing. And he said, because you've got a shin splint on one of your shin bones. And it was basically from years of swing dancing and doing performances on concrete. So that's probably the most impressive not running story I have.
I have a on-off relationship with running. Running is something I typically do when I'm very short of time. And at the moment, I've got loads of time. And also coupled with the fact that, you know, a lot of my focus is on cycle campaigning, normally I can't go anywhere on my bike really without fear of, being close past by a car driver, let alone take my kids out, which is something I'm doing a lot on the bike at the moment. So the fact that we're down to 1950s levels of motor traffic means that I'm taking every opportunity I can to cycle. But in normal times, especially when I'm working in London, typically I will try and run as much as I can for exercise. And I have one of those on-off relationships with it.
I think one of the things that's been coming up a lot for us is kind of running etiquette and the idea of who owns the space, I guess. Particularly in parks, there seems to be a kind of battleground between dog walkers and runners, although I feel like it's been slightly hyped up actually. How do you think that architecture and how public space looks and feels can help there? Do you feel there are solutions there, or is it just around people being super considerate to others?
I think from my point of view, I think Ned and Laura will have slightly different takes, but from my point of view, one thing that the COVID-19 crisis has done is highlight to lots of inverted commas normal folk who aren't interested in street design how woefully inadequate some street design actually is for pedestrians, whether they are or let's just call them people, people who are walking, people who are running, people who are cycling, people who want to sit, people who people who ultimately aren't in cars or in other forms of machines. And that kind of in this time of crisis, that kind of exacerbates because you need the space and the distance. And actually, we found this kind of weird predicament that councils find themselves in, where some of them are inclined to close the park to stop people gathering, but then people gather that don't. No one goes out to gather on purpose. Really, a very very small minority. People inadvertently then gather in the streets and areas around that because they're not designed for people or pedestrians. And those that are leaving their parks open, obviously kind of maybe see the bigger picture. But even then, you're seeing if there are levels of overcrowding, it's purely because most of the built environment is, like take Regent's Park, for example. There isn't Regent's Park in London, I should say. There isn't. It's a massive park, but it's also around its outer and inner perimeter, got these massive wide roads that are kind of a free for all for cars. And there isn't really a very good reason to drive around Regent's Park. The only reason you would be doing it is if you are a contractor or you are rat running to try and get through to Camden more quickly. Or you're paying £6 an hour to park to go and visit the zoo, which I don't think we should be encouraging in central London. So, parks like that have an inordinate amount of space dedicated to cars. And actually, I think that's at the hindrance of runners and walkers. Looking at some of the photographs that have been taken of Regent's Park and the kind of Broadwalk and other areas, they're taken with long lenses that make pedestrians look really close together. So we've kind of started to victimize pedestrians. And actually what it is, we've penned all our people into a small place because of the inordinate amount of space we give over to machines, I guess is how I see it.
Yeah, I think Hyde Park's a sort of case in point. I remember having a conversation with someone from the Royal Parks about this a couple of years ago. They put in these, or effectively rumble strips on one of the major cycling routes through the park. And you think about Regent's, think about Hyde Park, it's got this massive road around the edge, which is not really there for any clear reason. There's a main road that goes through just alongside it from Hyde Park Corner. But he was talking about using these basically bricks, lines of bricks along the cycle path to slow people down who are cycling. And it's also a major walking route. And he said, the main pinch point for us, the main conflict point comes at the crossing. And I said, and I asked him, is it a shared space? Are you sort of funneling people walking and people cycling in together? And he said, yes. And I was like, well, there's your problem. I mean, you've got all this space for cars, and then you separate that effectively from everyone else. But then you're expecting, people who are running, who are walking and cycling in the park to just be all thrown in together. And I don't see how you're surprised, really, but they didn't change anything. I don't think they took my point. But I think that basically the way that we design our streets and our parks does dictate people's behaviour. They take cues from their environment, just like a wide road encourages people to speed. I think, by sort of throwing different users in together, it just makes things very confusing. I think, like Adam said, there aren't that many other kind of places outside of parks. If you're all kind of working from home at the moment and your local park is the place to exercise, maybe your streets are quieter but aren't sort of super pleasant, maybe you're pavement parking, then you can understand why everyone's going to the same place. And I think if there were more places that are a bit more pleasant, you think about bits of Amsterdam, it's the city centre, the De Piep, the pipe, it's called De Piep. It's an inner city area, but it's got these beautiful streets with trees growing and there's barely any car parking and there's a sort of meandering path through the street. It would be a really nice place to sort of walk or run and cycle. We don't really have that in this country.
On your most recent episode, your guest, Dr. Ian Walker, he made a very interesting comment which sort of pertains to this, which was that physical space is possibly the most important determinant in over than thought and belief and in what we end up doing. So do you think it really is a sort of build it and they will come situation when it comes to infrastructure and people being more active?
Yeah, definitely. And we've kind of seen that now. The roads are a lot more quiet and obviously people have got more time on their hands because they're not commuting for work and many people aren't working at the moment because of the situation. But you are seeing a lot more people using the streets for different reasons. You talked about new runners and obviously we see new people cycling and people walking a lot more. It's been proven in London, central London, new cycle routes have been built and people will use it. And I think I remember when they were constructing the East-West Cycle Superhighway along the Victoria Embankment, which runs from Parliament to, it goes eastbound along the north side of the river. And before they'd completed it, there were loads of runners using it. And I think they still do during lunch breaks, people working. And it's really nice to see, actually, because it should be sort of space for everyone. You know, the street isn't, it should be a space that everyone can use.
We used to do a weekly 5K race along that road, along the embankment. Just not a huge number of people, but we used to do a staggered race where everyone was given a handicap and you set off according to your handicap, and we did it along there. And when that was being built, people got PBs because we could just go in the bike lane when it wasn't being used. It was great.
Because the built environment and urban design are fairly niche topics, even though they affect us all. I think one of the points I found really interesting throughout the COVID-19 crisis is the attitude and perception of what other people are doing, and I'm sure we'll end up talking about it in detail, but you know, this kind of pegging of us versus them, you know, whether it's in a newspaper headline or whether it's just discussion on social media or whether it's people's own viewpoint when they're out there. And we've now always used to be cyclists that were kind of labeled, I wanted to congratulate you guys as now being the hated but humans on the street, the accolade that you have. And I think this is part of the ridiculousness of it, because I think there are a couple of things that we should note. I think one is that every street design, as you were saying, Rick, needs some sort of system and built environment changes people behavior. So in a cycling sense, which is what I'm mostly talking about, you have, you know, cyclists should yield to pedestrians because pedestrians are the most vulnerable road users. Equally, cars should be yielding to bikes. And in many countries other than UK, we have what's called presumed liability, whereas, you know, if a car hits a person, a car driver hits someone on a bike, it is the car driver's fault and responsibility unless they can prove otherwise. And we have this kind of this hierarchy. We should have this hierarchy. And actually, when it comes to the kind of discourse we're having at the moment, it's actually more about the us versus them, which puts the total onus on the person, the people using this environment. And often I saw a video yesterday of New York where there's a four-lane carriageway going through the centre of New York, and then there's one of those really narrow footways where they're doing some building work, so it's even more narrow. And it's got, because it's a fast road, they put these massive metal gates to pen in pedestrians, so you cannot social distance. And you know, the initial instinct for the social media commenters go, look at those stupid people doing that. And the actual point of the, you know, an urban discussion about urban design is like, that should never happen. Where do we get to the situation where four lanes are given over to cars and more people are being carried over 1.5 meter stretch of sidewalk? So that's the kind of conversation we need to, I think we need to have about our built environment. And it links in a lot, I think, with those pedestrian gates that they're made. You know, you're seeing when you do a, when you cross a Pelican Crossing and you kind of get penned in this little gate until it's safe to cross the next side. Stuff like that isn't really for the safety of pedestrians. It's for the optimization of traffic flow. And while it's probably frustrating for a runner to be waiting at a traffic light so they can get a gap in the traffic to run across, really we want more people to be asking themselves, why is it like this? And is this the best it can be? Because the answer is probably no.
What's the, can I just chip in with a question here to you experts, you're running experts. What is the etiquette on waiting to cross a road? Do you jog up and down or do you just stand there?
Oh, a hotly debated topic, this one.
Have a whole,
I mean, you're going to start asking if you pause your Garmin or not.
If you pause your Garmin, exactly. What's the etiquette?
I mean, I think that the hopping on the spot is personal preference. I think it's people.
Yeah, I agree.
People are either fastidiously maintaining heart rate, so yeah, they want to make sure. So you know, they don't want it to drop too much, and they're, you know, yeah, they're mid tempo. They don't want to lose any of the effort. Or they've got a good song on, I think, is the other thing. You can see a few people dancing away.
True.
Yeah, I think it can be a bit of I think it can be a little bit of frustration from runners thinking, oh God, you know, I have to stop. So the very least I can do, well, I tell you what, I'll vent my frustration
running
by just running up and down. But it does seem to divide runners, I would say. Yeah, it's quite a divisive.
Massive.
Issue,
sorry, one. I've stirred up a hornet's nest and I didn't even realise it. what I have noted about runners in these crowded parks and streets situation that we have at the moment is that, and I'm kind of guilty to this to a certain extent as well, we're terrible creatures of habit. So if there's a certain, I mean, from my front door, I probably got, you know, 10 different runs that I do. And there's something quite nice about knowing exactly which one you're going to do, because you don't have to think about, am I going to turn left here or right here? Or you just follow the one you've always followed, you know, so you can relax into your run. But that doesn't work so well if you're running through a park and it's like really crowded and everybody sticks to the paths, don't they? I've noticed that some paths have appeared. This is another subject we were talking to Ian Walker about. They've appeared from nowhere. You know, like my local park has paths that didn't exist a couple of weeks ago. But then everybody follows that new path when there's a huge section of kind of open grass that they could just run across if they wanted to. And do you know what? There's nothing stopping me running across that bit. But you need to kind of flick a switch in your head and go, I don't have to do this. I don't have to be on this path. Look, I've got the freedom of the entire environment around me, you know.
I completely agree with you. It's a bugbear of mine, actually, particularly in nice weather, because it's not as if being off path now means being in kind of ankle deep mud. It's very, very easy to run off road in nice weather like this. And yeah, I actually think if you know, talk to a lot of elite runners, the vast majority of their miles are not on concrete. So it's not a kind of second rate option for people to not be on a path. In fact, your running actually might benefit from less kind of concrete based miles anyway. So yeah, I think all runners should be getting off the path. And I agree with what Adam said, that I do think the onus is on runners to move or to yield to pedestrians. I'm not saying that all pedestrians are fantastic, faultless path users, but I do think that if you're moving at speed and you're a bit more mobile, then yeah, actually just sort of common sense dictates that it should be you to move out of the way in the majority of situations, I think.
Yeah, this hierarchy, I think, is a valuable a valuable tool to bear in mind. And unfortunately also in the UK we have this narrative of everybody should share the road or everyone should share the space, and we're all, you know, everyone's got a responsibility too. And when you say that, it sounds totally reasonable. But if you think about it, there is no way that a car or a HGV turning left into a side street has as much responsibility as, you know, a pedestrian or someone in a wheelchair to keep each other safe. You know, there's this thing called physics, which sometimes gets in the way of this kind of societal argument. So I think it's really sensible to look at it from is a runner, you know, as a kind of law of physics, have they got I'm rubbish, I didn't listen at school, but like, I think if you're running faster, you're gonna have more mass or something. Someone will correct me. And if you knock into somebody or whatever, then it will have a bigger impact. So I think, you know, I think it's really sensible. The other thing that I would, you know, encourage runners, and when I'm running in London, which is where I do most of my running, I on the road, I'm kind of annoyed by, and I think more people should be annoyed by it, is, Laura, you'll tell me what the stat is because I can't remember, but we are we have the longest pedestrian waiting times in the world or Europe or something.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's one of the slowest in the world, one of the longest pedestrian wait times in the world. And I was wondering actually about runners as I was riding locally this morning. You know, the whole thing about having to push a button to cross the road must be a kind of added stress if you're running.
Yeah. There's also this big business opportunity. There's somebody selling little things that you can attach to your knuckles, like mini knuckle dusters that you can use to press buttons without contaminating yourself. So maybe that's what you need.
Yeah. Someone always needs an opportunity, don't they? Previously, I've said it in a kind of slightly jocular way, but I've talked about, you know, could we have running superhighways the same way that we had sort of cycling superhighways? And do you think like a measure like that would be welcome in cities, or do you think actually that the solutions are more subtle than something like that?
I think if a lot of people were sort of commuting running, which I know some people do, then I don't know, because with cycling superhighways, they were the ones in London, and I think a lot of the ones that have been built outside of London have been on major desire routes, basically. So people have calculated where the kind of low hanging fruit of cycling is, and then sort of calculated where they might be working, and it's usually sort of slightly wealthier areas into places of business in towns and cities. I'm not sure if I don't know, maybe in parks perhaps. I know you have running tracks. You were talking about in your last podcast about there's one in Herne Hill, I think you said, that you were doing a challenge on.
There's one in Dulwich.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. If it were a major commuting thing, then perhaps. But otherwise, I guess people are running in their neighbourhoods, like Ned said, or maybe... I don't know. It's an interesting one.
Do you remember seeing those mad designs for, I think it was called, it's going back a few years, they were wondering whether or not there was any viability of those things called bounce ways. Do anyone remember them?
Oh, I do. I think so. Yeah.
Is it for pogo sticking?
It was like what you said, like a running track, except it was even better than that. It was kind of a trampoline-y rubberized running track. So you could you could lope along as if you were on the moon at kind of 30 miles an hour, you know, as a runner. And they were literally thinking of trialing them along the river at one point. And that would have been a form of commuting by running on a bounced way. I'm sure if you put it into a search engine.
Why didn't that happen? That just sounds amazing.
I think it didn't happen because it was a fundamentally shit idea. I think that's why it didn't happen.
That can't be it. That's not a good enough reason for the government not to pass it.
I mean, they went along with the Garden Bridge idea for long enough,
yeah,
didn't they?
Yeah, I was going to say, it could be much worse than that.
Do you remember that? That was a cycle route that was going to be floating on the Thames.
When you're a city planner, of which I'm not, but from talking to them, you know, they're looking at the amount of people that everything in cities, especially, is a mathematical challenge to get as many people moving as possible in some challenging environments. And we were just talking to Chris Borman for a future episode, who's not only, you know, really keen on cycling, but make sure that walking is you know, as much as, if not more, of his job on a regular basis. And the reason is because walking is so accessible, and you know, 250 million trips in Manchester each year are under 1 kilometer by car. So these are fairly silly stats that can be easily resolved by getting more people walking. The issue, I guess, with human nature potentially is that we are inherently lazy, which is why, you know, people go for the most easy mode of transport. And if you make something really easy, people are likely to use it. So with walking, you know, we see some journeys that were walked now being overtaken by people, you know, maybe on electric scooters, for example, because, you know, people will always go for the easiest and most convenient mode of transport. Run commuting doesn't, to me, I'm happy to be corrected, but potentially doesn't fit into that kind of that train of thought, because a lot of people I know, at least, who run commute, you know, are doing it so they can get a substantial amount of running in as part of their day, and it, you know, and they're of a certain, I guess, seriousness that will allow them to run 8, 10, 12, 15k into work. And I think the beauty of the bike is that for a journey of that distance, almost anybody can do, you know, do a 5 or 6 mile cycle in, I don't know, half an hour or so, and be able to kind of, you know, and it's a really efficient way of moving people about. So I think run commuting, as long as it's focused on the distance, I think it will be quite hard to ever commandeer that amount of space. But what I would say is, there is, in parks, as Laura was mentioning, there's a lot of probably scope for the, we have these shared spaces, which I think largely work, but it depends what you define as sort of working, because, you know, are they dangerous? Well, I'd argue that they're, statistically, they're not dangerous. You know, if you have cyclists and walkers sharing the same shared usage path in a park or on a side street, statistically, very few collisions happen. But whether anybody, whether either party is massively enjoying themselves using that piece of infrastructure is another question. So I think especially where you've got more space, like in parks, having a often you have these dual usage paths. If they were actually split down the middle to cycling and walking and running, then that might be interesting. And then we could have another podcast on, you know, cyclists in the walking bit and walkers in the cyclist bit. But you know, these are all things that could potentially be considered.
So Laura, you mentioned Adam, you mentioned Manchester and some stats about sort of journeys and stuff. And I kind of, to bring it back to some harder data, Laura, you wrote about Milan and planning to transform 22 miles of streets into cycling and walking zones. Basically after, because during COVID-19, air pollution has dramatically fallen off in the city. Is it irrefutable evidence like that that's basically allowing for a stronger case to be made for these things to be pushed forward?
I think the air pollution in that region is a product of not only transport, it's a significant amount of it is sort of land transport, so people driving around, but it's also a very heavily industrialized area, to be fair, and it's got the Alps on one side, and then it's sort of, there's not much airflow, so it is a very polluted region because of a number of reasons. But I think what they're seeing in Milan, and what they were telling me is that thinking about relaxing restrictions in the coming sort of weeks and months, they're predicting people want to be avoiding public transport, basically. So although they've got a good metro system there, obviously there's a risk of infection if you're crowding lots of people together, and people are going to be naturally afraid of getting onto any sort of public transport. And because they've got fairly high levels of car ownership in Milan, I think it's like 51 cars per 100 people, which is quite high, and they can just see that what will happen as lockdown restrictions are lifted is that everyone's going to be rushing to those cars, and obviously there's a huge issue then for air pollution, for congestion, and also for businesses. And one of the things that they wanted to protect specifically was the restaurants, which have obviously been closed down for a long time, and they're a big part of Italian culture, a big part of European culture, you know, sitting out, eating a meal on the street. And if the cars rush back, then having restaurants opening with social distancing, which means they're going to need more space, will be very difficult. So it's part of their economic recovery plan, I would say, as well as the fact that they want to protect their residents, they want to enable social distancing. And they already had these quite exciting plans. They did the open plazas, and the new plan is called open streets. And so they've already done some of this stuff through what's called tactical urbanism, which was learned from New York. And it's basically taking paint and planters. It's very low cost, very quick to implement. And they'll put it out, and then people can decide whether they like it or not, and then they'll consult. And it's much easier to do it that way because, you know, people, it's quite hard to imagine your street different to the way it is. And, you think, well, where will all the cars go? And actually people will drive less if it's nicer to walk and cycle and it's harder to drive. So I think that there's very, very good and sensible reasons for cities doing that. And I think a lot of cities are going to be looking to Milan because they're ahead of us in terms of their curve. And they were obviously very badly hit by COVID-19. So it'll be interesting to see how they do it.
Yeah, I mean, because as a sort of a case study of what can be achieved, it feels like that's a super positive way of using the situation.
The other thing that we have on the agenda, I think, is air quality. And this struck me the last time I did a major run. I, being a slight transport nerd, I created my own Victorian Railway Terminus half marathon. in central London. It has actually That's become brilliant. A classic.
Yeah. Sounds amazing, Adam.
Before you tell that story, can I just say, one of the first times I ever did a long bike ride, I needed, just like you've just done, I needed something to kind of string it all together and make sense of it. So I decided to visit every single football league football ground in the Greater London area and take a picture of myself outside. So I did it, and it's surprisingly long, actually. It's like 85 miles or something. And then I got back, and I uploaded to my dad every single picture of me standing outside every single football ground in Greater London, thinking he, by the way, I was about 40 when I did this, thinking that he'd be impressed. And he just sent me back an email saying, what about QPR? So I hope you got all your Victorian terminuses done.
What I realized from running to all of these stations is that they the way London was built with these kind of terminus stations on the outskirts, people would come into Euston or King's Cross or Fenchurch Street, etc., and then kind of go into the other center via other means. But the way, you know, naturally we've built big roads outside of these stations as well, so especially on you've got the Euston Road up by King's Cross, Euston, then going over to Marylebone and Paddington, you're pretty much all across that corridor, and it's an awful road. It's one of the most polluted in London,
in Europe,
there we go. It's pretty god awful. And I was running along it thinking, listening to a podcast on air quality, and it was it totally cracked me. It got me thinking about, you know, the fact that a lot of people listen to this, and a lot of your readers will be, you know, live in cities and be running and be, you know, hopefully concerned or increasingly concerned about air quality. And I think one of the other kind of big levers, as Laura was saying, is that air quality is having a big effect on coronavirus. So Harvard University have done a study based on data in the US showing that an increase of 1 micrograms per cubic meter, which is kind of the measure of PM2.5, which is particulate matter air pollution. It's the tiny stuff that really gets into the back of your lungs, and people are really worried about the effect it will have on children. Just one increase of 1 point on that will have a 15% increase on the COVID-19 death rate. And other studies showing in Italy that, I'm not a scientist, as we've already kind of made clear, but COVID-19 particles is effectively clinging onto tiny air particles as well. So if one of the things that might come out of this, and, you know, thinking about levers for change to get our streets more pedestrian friendly and more cycle friendly, could be that, you know, the alternative, which is loads more cars, because bear in mind, lots of people will want to be driving around in private cars after this crisis because they'll think it's the safest thing to do, is going to make the whole environment much, much worse. So that's something, you know, runners can also, along with, you know, cycle campaigners and pedestrian campaigners can get behind, because it really affects us and it is a great lever for change.
And with like the levers for change and changing a city, presumably there's a cost, isn't there? And what are the obstacles around a city like London becoming more pedestrian friendly?
Ooh. I think it's in London. It's a that's a good question. Yeah, just do it anyway. It's fine. We can just go out with some cones next week. Socially distance. Well, in London's kind of, I guess it's like a lot of larger cities, in that Transport for London only manages 5% of the roads, and the other 95% are spread across 32 boroughs, some of whom love walking and cycling and some don't. And so it's about sort of which politicians are in place in which location and what they are willing to do. And I think pedestrianising, I would love to see Soho pedestrianised, for example. I just think it's ludicrous that people are allowed to razz around quite often at speed in their vehicles around there. And there's all these lovely small businesses, and it could be a walking paradise, but unfortunately it isn't. And I know Westminster Council is one of the ones that aren't so keen on walking and cycling. But I think it's sort of political will, effectively. It's not... doesn't have to be expensive. Like Milan has learned from New York, you can do these things very cheap. I mean, when they pedestrianized Times Square, they did it with some planters and some paint, and then they realized that no one was actually using the space, so they went out and bought some deck chairs from a DIY store, or from a sort of homeware store, and just plonked them out, and it was absolutely full within, you know, a matter of hours. And so, yeah, it's the only thing really holding it back is just having the politicians there willing to kind of tell businesses everything's going to be okay, because we know that people-friendly streets, walking and cycling space on streets, increases business revenue, makes people want to stop and sit and spend time in a place because it's more relaxing. And it's just about sort of communicating that to business owners, who are quite often scared, very much understandably, of change. So that's really all that's holding it back. I mean, obviously you need some space for deliveries, but that can all be managed. That's managed in other cities.
I think there's always a question of budget, but it does come down to political will. I think, as we've seen during this coronavirus crisis, we do, when we want to, have the ability to take some quite extreme financial measures to make sure that there are, you know, the right things can happen at the right time. And I think, you know, cycling and walking, the most recent announcement from the central government puts it about £1.2 billion over 5 years, which sounds like a lot, but it's really not a lot at all for the whole country, for, you know, things like cycling infrastructure, etc. To put it into context, they're the same plan over roughly the same time frame is for A roads and trunk roads is £27 billion. So really, and there's actually the same people who did a legal challenge and Transport Action Network for the Heathrow third runway and were successful in getting the government to claw back the kind of third runway plans, are actually going after this £27 billion fund for major roads. Now, there is lots of funding available. You know, having said that, there is lots of funding available for active travel schemes and kind of other schemes like that. And it's worth noting that it's a really good investment if you have, as Laura said, got that political will and kind of courage to follow it through. For every, according to DFT, Department for Transport, every £1 spent delivers £5.50. back in economic and kind of health benefits to the community it serves. So if you can find that quid in the first place, it makes a really logical investment. Whereas a lot of car driving, private car driving, actually costs society money in terms of, you know, air quality has an effect on the NHS, it has an effect on productivity, congestion has an effect on productivity. So the money is there. You need that will, and I think that kind of will needs to come from a reframing of how people measure success. So every transport engineer, you know, in the last 30, 40, 50 years is really basing their success on traffic flow. So how quickly, how many cars can they get through a junction without without them stopping or without it being too much congestion? And that's what leads to those ridiculous, you know, long pedestrian waiting times, or even in the case of the Euston Road, there are no pedestrian crossings because they're telling you, we don't want you to cross the road because we would like to keep cars going. And now increasingly we're seeing other councils, not loads, but like councils like Hackney and others thinking, actually, wouldn't it be better if we measured our success on how healthy our borough is, or how happy our borough is, or the quality of life measures? And that's the opposite measurement to traffic flow. You know, they're not, you can't have both.
I think there's a danger and an opportunity, isn't there, when we come out of this crisis and slowly try and rebuild the economy. I mean, my great fear for the end of my road, where there's a little high street with a couple of dozen shops, is I worry for those small business owners, how many of them are going to be able to reopen, and if so, for how long. I think there's going to be a lot of vacant properties on the high street. That's been the case for a number of years now. And there will, in order to rescue the high street, particularly the local high street, they are going to have to do some brave financial remodeling. You know, business rates are going to have to be suspended. They're going to have to be rate capping for, rent capping for private landlords, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's very important that people like you, Adam, are center stage in that discussion, because there could be some bad decision making resulting from that out of fear.
Yes.
You know, so simultaneously, people are thinking, this is a remarkable time. We are ripping up the old order, and there is the potential to emerge from this with some better things in place. But at the same time, there's a feeling that almost runs in the opposite direction to that of, I just want it back as it was. You know, the phrase, the new normal, strikes fear into people, because what they actually want is the old normal on steroids, you know. So that is the danger and the potential all right there, isn't it? I think in the same mix.
Laura, Ned, Adam, thank you so much for joining us. Your podcast Streets Ahead, so people should go and have a listen to that, is on to episode 3, I reckon, just about now. So everyone should go and search that. But thank you so much for joining and for chatting through this infinitely difficult and interesting topic.
Thanks very much, guys. Thanks for the invite. Cheers.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Yeah, great to speak with Ned, Adam, and Laura about that. Hey, it's a bumper episode, this, because I also caught up with Eleanor Davis, who's a elite marathon runner. She ran a 2:33 marathon in Valencia, and she was due to be running London on the weekend, but obviously that has been turned on its head. And she's actually she's also a doctor, so she's working instead in the COVID-19 area of a hospital. She's incredible, absolutely amazing person, very inspiring, and I got to catch up with her this week, and this is what she has to say. First of all, thanks very much for making time to speak with me for the Runner's World podcast. It's I'm aware that it's a very stressful time for you, and it's just amazing what I've been told you're doing. It sounds like
yeah, just absolutely extraordinary to try to keep up your running, obviously, but also to deal with one of the most stressful professional situations I think anyone could be in.
Yeah, it's very different. Didn't expect to be here sort of a few months ago, but yeah, doing okay under the circumstances.
So I guess yesterday you had planned originally to be, you know, towing the start line at the London Marathon and probably with an eye on the Olympics as well. And obviously all that's been turned on its head. And you, I guess you found that were you working again yesterday in the sort of COVID-19 ward?
Yeah, it was a bit odd, really. I sort of got up to do my run to work. And then as I got there, sort of just before nine, I was just thinking, you know, I was sort of meant to be standing on the start line with all the other elite women heading off. And it was sort of perfect marathon conditions as well yesterday morning, which made it hurt a little bit more not to be there. So, yeah, odd.
I'm interested in how, because I think a lot of people have continued to run through this crisis and a lot of people have kind of come to running. I've certainly found myself that running has helped me to stay fit physically and mentally. And for you, how has running helped you during this time, would you say?
I mean, massively. I think the first week I found it really tough, mainly because I was in the shape of my life, really, and I just had the week, probably the best week of training I'd ever had. I was really excited about what I could possibly do at London. I had most of the miles in the bank ready to go. So sort of the first week was just pretty hard to come to terms with that. I wasn't going to be able to use all the hard work towards anything for a while. But then sort of when that passed and I realised sort of the gravity of the situation and how sort of priorities needed to change, I kind of really was thankful to still have running and also a bit anxious that it was going to be taken away from us, because I think for a period we weren't sure whether we were going to be as restricted as other countries in terms of not being able to go out running at all.
Yeah.
So sort of every run I did do, I was thankful for, kind of expecting on the news for Boris to say, you know, complete lockdown. And, you know, I've taken my foot off the pedal a little bit with in terms of intensity, but I'm still doing about the same amount of miles, mainly because of fitting them in. So I run to and from work, so that that builds up the miles quite quickly.
Is it also for someone who is kind of like an elite runner like yourself, does running have that kind of de-stressing aspect, or is it a bit more intense than that when it comes to the kind of the action end of running?
Yeah, definitely. It's a massive de-stressor for me. I think when I'm injured, the main thing I miss is that side of it. You know, when I'm at work, it's quite intense, and you have some really difficult days. Sort of, you know, emotionally, it can be quite difficult. So, sort of, my running is my outlet, and actually, I find even the faster running helps me the most. So, if I have a session, I can really sort of bury my head in it, and I don't think about anything else, and it just really gets any sort of stress out of my system. So, I'm still doing those sessions now just because I love running fast, just for those reasons, and it gets I get most endorphin buzz from my big sessions, I've kept those sort of things in, but yeah, running to and from work, sort of when I go to work and I've done a little run there, I start feeling good and ready for the day, and then, you know, when I go home, I find the first miles pretty tough.
I bet, yeah.
You feel a bit like you've been hit by a bus after a day at work sometimes. But sort of when I get into it and stuff, it improves, and I sometimes decide to run the long way home, just depending how I feel, and sort of get home feeling much better for it. So, it definitely helps.
Is there a worry, Ellen? I guess that naturally there would be that you would catch COVID-19 working in a COVID-19 ward. I know it's a concern for a lot of sort of frontline staff.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised I haven't caught it already. Obviously, I'm taking all the precautions, but it is really contagious. But I guess being a runner, I'm really paranoid about my immune health at the best of times anyway.
Right.
Over time, I've sort of built up ways to protect myself as much as possible, because obviously before big marathons, you know, before Valencia, I was still working on the wards and stuff. So I'm very sort of aware of protecting myself from it in terms of good nutrition, enough rest, bits and bobs like that. Yeah, I guess obviously I am expecting to get it at some point. but you know, I am, you know, fit and healthy, and hopefully it shouldn't affect me too much, but you know, it doesn't always discriminate. But I guess, you know, it's not something I go into work and I'm really fearful of, really.
How do you normally balance running with your work?
So I'm lucky in that a few years ago I decided to go part-time, which the hospitals have been really supportive of. You know, I've sort of explained about competing to fairly high level, and I work 60% of a full-time rota, so
right.
that works out to about 30 hours a week still, which means that I can still do what, you know, I do love my job, so I can still do that and train. And I find I actually quite like having work away from training. I found sort of when I went on training camps in the past, I just found having all that time off in between, I would ruminate about, you know, the session I've got to do later on, and I wouldn't perform as well. Or I found that, you know, working in a way is a nice distraction from running as well.
Right. So you've also got involved with this, the 2.6 challenge. We spoke a bit about that on the Runners World podcast last week. Do you want to tell us what challenge you're getting involved with or you've done?
Yeah, so I just got in touch with all the other girls who were due to run on the Elite Start, the British girls. You know, there was meant to be an amazing showdown because of, you know, the depth of talent there at the minute. Four of those girls already had the Olympic qualifying time, and who knew what sort of shape people would be in the day. It was sort of going to be quite exciting. And there were 12 of us due to run off that start, British girls. So I just contacted them. And so it's just sort of seeing if they wanted to do something together to mark the day and also sort of raise money for the charities that were missing out from London not going ahead. So we sort of decided to raise money for Mind Charity. We did 2.6 miles each, which probably doesn't seem like much of a challenge to girls who run sort of 100 miles a week. But I guess for us, it was more about the challenge of the psychological challenge of not being able to race and compete that day. Sort of doing something together.
I think it's great. Yeah, I've seen the accompanying video on their Instagram page as well, which is really funny.
Yeah, it was really fun. It was good making that.
Can you tell us what a week looks like for you now? Because I think it'd be fascinating for people to kind of work out how, both from a running and a working perspective, what would a kind of typical week look like?
I do my normal shift, so Tuesday, Thursday and Friday on the normal wards.
Right.
That sort of, I'm a GP trainee at the minute. So I sort of I'm on a ward where it's sort of elderly people who've fallen and broken their hips.
Yep.
And sort of caring for them in their recovery. So I will normally, on those days, I'll sort of get up and fairly early and pack my bag and run to work. I have sort of my breakfast when I get there. And then hit the ward for the day, sort of ward rounds and speaking to relatives and things like that. And then, I guess that's sort of a 9-to-5 job.
Yeah.
And then after that, just running home. And like I said, I sort of, at the minute, my coach has given me sort of free rein to decide what I do each day in terms of mileage, just because, you know, I know how tired I am or how hard the day's been. So she doesn't want me to feel pressured to sort of, if she sets 10 miles, to feel like I should trudge around and do it just because it's on the plan.
Right.
So that's worked really well. So sometimes I'll even run a long way into work if I've woken up feeling really good. And then, you know, most days I'll run sort of 5 miles to work, and then I'll do about 10 on the way home with a few strides if I'm feeling good. So that's what I do. So, and then I'm doing normally, depending on what, so my wife's a doctor as well.
Yeah.
So she's a consultant in emergency medicine in Manchester. So
you're both very busy then at the minute, I should say.
Yeah. So I'm trying to match the shifts that I'm picking up on the coronavirus wards. I'm trying to match when she's working too, so that the time we have off, we're off together.
Nice.
Right. So, yeah, normally that would be on a weekend. I'll do the extra shifts on the coronavirus wards and the same about miles around that. And I sort of try and put my sessions I'm still doing on the days I have off, just so that I'm sort of recovering well after them and I've got time to chill and eat properly. And then sort of I'm still fitting in about 3 gym sessions a week. I managed to source some gym kit finally, so
this is kind of home workout kit, is it?
Yeah, I've ended up getting some shipped from Spain. So
okay, right, yeah.
But that's been really handy. And I'll probably continue doing that after lockdown because you actually waste quite a lot of time, like driving to the gym.
I agree,
and things
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
So it's actually probably a bit of a silver lining that I've now got that and can squeeze in sort of the essence, the yeah. strength and conditioning around being in the house.
Yeah, I agree. I think I feel exactly the same. I'm like, we're lucky enough to have a garden. So I'm like, actually being in the garden compared to being on like a sweaty gym mat in a really packed London gym, like, I think I'd rather be yeah. in my garden doing this. And like, there's a few yeah. things you can't do, aren't there? Like, you probably can't get the battle ropes out or something, but you could probably do 80 or 90% of the stuff you'd normally do.
Yeah. I mean, at one point before my gym equipment arrived, I was back squatting my wife, which I wouldn't recommend, by the way. and I find that I need to load my, I get Achilles problems. So
right.
if I don't load them, you know, with the Smith bar, if I don't put weight on me and do the calf yeah. raises, then they flare up. So I've been getting her to sort of push down on my shoulders while I do that.
It's amazing how resourceful people have been, I think, during this time. Yeah, yeah, people find yeah. a way, don't they?
Yeah, I've been sort of stealing ideas from other people as well, so it's been good.
Do you think that we'll look at running differently once this, well, hopefully once this crisis is over? Do you think it's kind of changed your perspective on running or maybe just on life?
Yeah, definitely. I think I've definitely appreciated that I don't actually run because just to race and to win stuff. I run because I love it. And you know, even if I couldn't compete, I would definitely still run. And I think I probably, 100% will appreciate all the races.
yeah, right.
I think everyone will, you know, won't be taking racing for granted again. Because I do, you know, I do miss it. And I miss that feeling of having a race coming up and the excitement around that and the buzz afterwards. So, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think a lot of people will really cherish once they're back on the in a big race. It will feel quite special, I think, for sure.
Yeah, whenever that may be.
Have you kind of dared to have hopes for this year as from a running perspective, or do you think that in some ways it's better just to think kind of short term and just, you know, week by week when it comes to training?
Yeah. So when London was cancelled, I thought, well, in the summer, I was going to do some mountain races and try and get on the GB team for the World Mountain Championships.
Yeah.
But that that's in November. But then the sort of trials for that got postponed, and it just, you know, so now I'm not thinking about it too much. I'm staying fit, and I'm just sort of trying to be a bit more present with the running. But I guess we just don't know, do we?
No, exactly. Yeah.
But I sort of am fit and ready for when the restrictions get released. And I guess there's been some talks of maybe just elite races going ahead. I'm not sure about that, but I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's a lot of it's up in the air, isn't it? To be confirmed. I'm interested in your your journey as a runner. Is it something where you were always a fantastic junior, or did you get into running slightly later? What's been your journey into it?
No, so at school I ran a lot at school for in cross country, yeah. But I was never very, you know, very good. We had a really good team at school, actually. Our school team did really well nationally. We won national titles, but I would be at the back of that squad. But actually, our coach then was amazing, and he sort of valued every runner no matter their speed. So he didn't sort of have he wouldn't favor the fastest one, and he would sort of make you feel appreciated no matter where you placed in the team. And I think that put me in really good stead, sort of, and kept me interested and involved in that through school. And I sort of think this maybe the strength I got from there has helped later on, but I sort of drifted away from it a little bit at college and when I went to medical school. I was a bit of a party animal for a bit, and then I think I still went out for the occasional runs, and then I just decided one year that I wanted to run a marathon, and sort of told my dad, who's a really good marathon runner, he's done I can't tell you how many sub 3 hours he's done, but he's sort of 60, he's 61 now, but he ran a sub 3 last year.
Oh, wow. Right.
So, yeah, he was a big inspiration, sort of do a marathon. And he, you know, obviously was quite keen for me to do it too. So we sort of, he helped me with that. And we went out together sort of every Sunday in the build up to my first one.
Yeah.
And he'd wait, sort of, I'd be mostly hungover on those days. So he'd have to wait a bit longer before he could head out with me. And then, yeah, I did my first one, Paris it was, and I did it in, I think it was 3:47, and I was sort of over. Yeah. I didn't expect to get under 4 hours, so I was absolutely over the moon with that. I'd forgotten socks and things like that, and you know, I wasn't prepared at all, and just, I think I borrowed a pair of my dad's, and I just had the worst blisters for weeks. But you know, I think I got the bug after that, and just thought, oh, I could sort of do a different one in a different city each year.
Yeah, right.
So and then each time I went back, I just kept knocking sort of 10 minutes off, and obviously you get a massive buzz from that.
But I mean, you really have chipped away at that, haven't you? That's like, you know, you've obviously taken like an hour and 15 minutes off your debut time. And was it like that? Was it in kind of 10-minute increments, or did you have a bit of a moment where you're like, actually, I'm good at this, and you knocked like half an hour off it or something?
I think it was very much just chipped away. The biggest jump I would say was I got to sub 3 hours without coaching. So,
right.
Obviously I had my dad to help a little bit, but I did 2:58 eventually. And then after that, I picked up a coach, and that's when I made the jump really, when I had a bit more focused training. I went from 2:58 to 2:40.
Okay. So
I think that was probably the most significant jump I did. And then after that, had a lot of injury issues, just mainly because of I was working full time.
Yes.
Just wasn't very clued up about recovering and things like that. I was just trying to do too much, I think. I sort of got a bit of a nickname at the hospital of Dr. Boot, because I was in an air cast boot more than I was out. each injury I learned something new, and I've got to the point now where, you know, I think I'm pretty clued up on how to avoid injury as much as possible. Obviously it's not completely unavoidable, but there are lots of things you can do to prevent it and look after yourself.
This all kind of led to this fantastic run in Valencia, wasn't it, where it was like you run 2:33, was it?
Yeah. So that was a really special moment, actually, because I think I trained for 5 marathons between that London in 2015.
Yeah.
In doing 2:42, I trained for 4 or 5 different marathons and got to like the week before or 2 weeks before, and most of them, and something went wrong and meant I couldn't run.
Mm.
You know, one year I got flu, I think, the week before. Another year I got a stress fracture 2 weeks before.
Oh, wow.
And sort of the day before Frankfurt, my Achilles was so inflamed. I even flew there and I couldn't run. I just had and then just before London, the year before, I got a tibial stress fracture. It's just running, but when you put so much into it, it gets a bit, you know, a bit heartbreaking at times. Mm. To be able to pull it off finally, you know, with the help of my coach, Helen, it was a really good day.
Yeah. And it sounds like you were in really good shape for when London might have been as well.
Yeah. That's a frustrating thing is, you know, at the minute I'm in the shape of my life, but nowhere to put it. I think we were sort of hoping for sub 2:30. Yeah, so, but, you know, it can wait.
Yeah, I think it's remarkable that you've managed to keep running as much as you are, given what you're having to do in parallel as well. Eleanor, thank you so much for making the time to speak with me for the Runner's World podcast. It's really inspiring to talk to you.
It's okay, thanks for having me on.
Are you back on the ward today, or have you got a day off?
Day off today, back in tomorrow.
Okay, great. Well, Thanks very much for making time to speak with us, and best of luck with the running and all the fabulous work you're doing at the hospital.
Thank you very much.
All right, cheers, Anna. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Cheers, Kate. Bye.
So that brings us to the end of this week's Runner's World podcast. A big thanks to our guests, Adam, Laura, Ned and Eleanor. And thanks to you, of course, for listening.
The Runner's World podcast is available on Acast, iTunes and all of your favourite podcast apps. Please just search Runner's World UK. If you've enjoyed the episode, please do give us a review and remember to tune in next week.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.